This week on Art on the Air features multimedia artist using his own radical relief style, Matthew Kowalski, who's also a musician, motivational speaker, and certified addiction counselor. Next, author and photographer Michelle Steiner, working as a paraeducator in a school with students with disabilities. Our spotlight's a Chicago Street Theater production of The Half-Life of Marie Curie, running February 14th through March 1st.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the air our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world.
Welcome. You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, WVLP 103.1 FM, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. I'm Larry Breckner of New Perspectives Photography, right alongside here with Esther Golden of The Nest in Michigan City.
Aloha, everyone.
We're your hosts for Art on the Air. Art on the Air is heard every Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org. And is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Also heard on Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at WVLP.org. Our spotlight interviews are also heard Wednesdays on Lakeshore Public Media. Information about Art on the Air is available at our website, breck.com/AOTA. That includes a complete show archive, spotlight interviews, plus our show is available on multiple podcast platforms, including NPR One. Please like us on Facebook, Art on the Air, WVLP, for information about upcoming shows and interviews. I'd like to welcome to Art on the Air Spotlight, back again from the Chicago Street Theater, and they'll be celebrating their new show coming up in February, February 14th through the 1st, The Half-Life of Marie Curie. And the director, Allison Granite, is here, and she's going to tell us all about what's coming on with that, and maybe a few things coming on. Allison, welcome back to Art on the Air Spotlight to tell us about the show.
Hi, thank you guys for having me back. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, it's nice to see you again.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about, why you picked the show and then maybe some of the rehearsal process that's leading up to it. It's kind of a different type of subject.
So it's kind of interesting. I actually wasn't the original director slated for this production, but I stepped in after the previous director couldn't. And I was approached with the script seeing if I was interested, and I read it through while I was in the middle of my last show I was directing. And I was really taken by Gunderson's writing. She's a very prolific writer, and she tends to write about pretty strong women or women that we kind of overlook a lot. And I love I love science too, so I am very much akin to this. And learning more about Marie Curie and Hertha Ayrton was very interesting to me. So it follows the friendship between Hertha and Marie Curie. Most people actually don't know who Hertha Ayrton is. She's the mother of like fluid dynamics and ripples, basically, for us. And she created the fans that we used in World War II, or War One and Two, for chemical warfare. So Marie Curie obviously is the mother of radium and radioactivity. So it follows their relationship as Marie is dealing with the fallout of an affair with a married man.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, so it's these women with their friendship kind of navigating this space and how they lean on one another. And then they're dealing with like topics of the time and suffrage and things like that as well. So it's very interesting that Hertha like whisks her away to escape this kind of cacophony of emotions, and you get to hear about their thoughts and feelings about men, science, just love in general. And it's very, very interesting and moving.
You know, that was a tough time for women to do things, not only just their normal independence, but to be taken seriously in science and, all other things. That's a very dynamic time, both in our history, but the history for women.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and the talent of this script is that, like, it's dealing with some very heavy topics, but it's done with a lot of humor and wit and really emphasizing the friendship and the pioneering aspect of both of those women.
We've just started our rehearsals at this point, but I have two phenomenal actresses, Lisa Formosa Parmigiano and Barb Malagoni, both veterans to the stage. They're both amazing actresses, and I'm very blessed to have them both. And not only do they just capture the depth and the weight of the words and just what they're dealing with, but we were just laughing the other night by how funny these women are, not only like them as performers, but Hertha and Marie. And it's just, it was so hilarious to hear some of these asides and these like some of the barbs that they throw at one another. And it's really, really fun, which you didn't think would happen with such heavy issues sometimes, but
because well, that's people true think, friendship though.
Oh, really? Yeah. Like, I was thinking about my best friend when we were watching one of the scenes, like, oh, you're only your best friend can really dish it out to you, but also mean it with love as well. So we were very much laughing about that. There's definitely a lot about relationships in this that is very, very moving.
So off from this, what brought you to directing? I mean, did you come from a performing background, or how did you get to into the directing mode?
So I've done a little bit of directing on and off since college. I've expressed an interest in it at Chicago Street for a while. I helped AD Misery a couple years ago, and I did all the fight choreography and some of the scenes in that. And it was nice to kind of stretch my wings a little bit. And then I did Rules for a Living this past year, and that was just everything to me, and I loved it very much. And so it's kind of nice to step outside my comfort zone a little bit. I do normally like comedies or like actiony kind of things. So something with a little bit more interpersonal drama and history is a little bit more serious. I am very interested to delve more into that at this time.
Our audience can't see this, but there's a whole range of books behind you. What's that about?
Well, I actually live in a partial library. I'm a librarian in my day job. So I actually have a ton of books. I have a handful of my movies behind me that I love. You probably can see my Frasier set here, share it with my family. But very like to read, and I like history and I love science. So I'm kind of surrounded by it.
Is there anything down the road here you're either wanting to act in or direct?
I would love, well, I'm hoping there's been talk about possibly in the region, somebody doing Pride and Prejudice. I would love to do that. Maybe The Shark is Broken. I love Jaws and movies, so maybe that hopefully in the future, but we'll see. I'm open to anything, but, yeah.
Well, in our final moments here, we want to give you a chance to tell us about dates for the show, how they can get tickets and everything else.
Yeah, absolutely. Our run goes from February 13th to March 1st. My AD, Reese and I will be there at the theater helping out. But you guys can get your tickets through our website at chicagostreet.org, or you can call into our box office.
That's great. That's Allison Granite. She's the director of Half-Life of Mary Curry, February 14th through March 1st, chicagostreet.org. You can call them 219-464-1636. Allison, thank you so much for coming on Art on the Air Spotlight and sharing.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Art on the Air Spotlight and the complete one-hour program on Sunday is brought to you by Emberforge Consulting. With end-to-end expertise in learning strategy, design, and implementation, Emberforge turns your organization's knowledge into impact. To learn more, visit emberforgeconsulting.com. And as a reminder, if you'd like to have your event on Art on the Air Spotlight or have a longer feature interview, email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com.
This is Bethy Lovelight, and I'm a star rockin' musician, and you're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media 89.1 FM and on WVLP 103.1 FM.
We are happy to welcome Matthew Kowalski to Art on the Air. Matt creates multimedia paintings in his own radical relief style. He is a retired certified addiction counselor, motivational speaker, and author who worked with recovering addicts in both clinical and 12-step settings for more than 20 years. A professional multi-instrument musician, he plays drums and guitar and sang with dozens of bands throughout his life, and continues to seek opportunities to play in Northwest Indiana. Thank you for joining us on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome, Matt. It's very nice meeting you.
Mahalo.
Well, Matt, and of course, we've met several times, crossed paths at various exhibit openings, but we want to thought, that's why I thought you'd be a great guest to share your story with our audience. And how we start off our interviews is talk about your origin story, how you got from where you were to where you are now. So tell us all about Matt.
Well, thank you, Larry, and thank you, Esther. It's a very it's an honor to be here, and thank you for your service to our deserving communities. I'd like to shout out to thank my beautiful wife for all the support she does. Without her, I would be a messy puddle on the floor. So I just want to make sure I say that out loud. My origin story is, in recovery terms, basically great-grandfather ran away from Poland, grandfather ran away, father ran away. I was 15 and pretty much kicked out, beaten till I poop, piss, or bled. And that's the hard story, but I'll go into the more soft one for you. Born in Topeka, Kansas, the Wizard of Oz, trailer turned over once when I was in it with no one home during a tornado. We moved to Morocco, Africa. I was 3 to 6 years old. I was running around playing half naked, having fun, peeing anywhere I wanted and enjoying my life because I was just a native there. I didn't know I was white. I thought I was a light, dark skinned person my whole life. So I got to have fun in the desert, meeting beautiful people over there. And I want to just shout out the people in all of those countries are gorgeous, wonderful, loving, kind, generous people. And they're getting bad rep right now from our country. And I want to stop being the ugly American around the world. I want to put on that beautiful American smile and be able to travel anywhere safely because I represent what I believe. Morocco was beautiful, amazing. I had a black Santa, had a black Jesus. And I came here and I saw this white Santa Claus. I was like, what's going on here? So it just shows that no matter where you're from, it's okay what you think you know. And there's 193 other countries out there. And I want to honor all 193, as well as our own, on a very small village called Planet Earth. Moved Delaware, New Jersey, England, Florida, ran away at 15 to California, and just spent 27 years homeless. But when I was getting beat, I could hit back, and I didn't choose to fight. But I'm just saying, if I was getting beat, I could protect myself. So basically, a lot of trauma I've overcome. That's why I'm a skilled clinician helping people with mental health and addiction problems. Played rock and roll through the whole thing, playing with 35-year-old men when I was 14, 13, 12. So I was a very old 15-year-old by the time I ran away. And then it was just sex, drugs, and rock and roll till I was 42 years old. I had gotten Hep C with a Hell's Angel-type pagan when I was 12 or 13. My father was part of the Air Force and brought bodies back. All American bodies go to Dover, Delaware. So the morticians in Vietnam and the morticians in Dover, Delaware had the biggest heroin ring going. And so here I was, my father's son. He didn't know it, but he was bringing them back and our young servicemen. And they would cut the armpit and put the heroin there and pull it out when they got to the United States. So I unknowingly got it when I was 12 or 13, where I lived. And just the coincidences, my father was with the Bay of Pigs, and he moved us to the Atlas Mountains because he was flying around the atom bomb. Pretty much most of my life, he was mutual assured destruction in the air with a bomb or bodies from a war. So he wasn't the kindest, most gentle person. I think I'll stop there and let you redirect my energy.
Okay, so I'm going to try to follow the timeline. So you were in, was it Topeka, Kansas, when you were infant toddler? And at that point, there was a tornado that knocked over your, like, caravan, and you were on your own at that point?
I don't remember that. I remember my dad said that happened. I remember just he wasn't skillful. He didn't – I would hold my breath around him. He put me in cold water. I learned to swim real good because I was holding my breath underwater too then. You know what I mean? So a lot of more to the point, a lot of trauma. That's why my book is called Riding Shotgun Through a Hurricane. You know, a lot of trauma was endured through my life.
Okay, and so after that, you moved. And so is that the next place? Did you say Morocco? Or
yes.
So the next place was Morocco. And is that where there was your first education, I guess? Did you go to...
I was 3 to 6 years old, so we
walked 3 to 6, okay.
With natives with big baskets on their head, and you know all of the stuff you saw from African history.
Your visual the visuals at that age really stick with you, and all the images I've seen of Morocco, and my friends go there frequently. It's like overwhelmingly beautiful. So you've got these beautiful. So, like, I'm trying to piece together what I've seen of your work and your life. And so it's sort of all kind of coming together a little bit at this point.
Yeah.
And so then you come back to the States. And is that where, you're in school at that point? Is that, I'm just trying to find out what your art background is. Because your art is quite multi-layered. And I can't wait to come to, like, how you have come up with your style. But what was your art education background at that point? And from what you're telling me, there wasn't a whole bunch of art going in the household. But I might be wrong about that.
Well, a lot of, like I said, a lot of holding your breath.
Right.
It wasn't, but as I got, okay, I'll try to help you out here. Okay. I went to preschool. I got ADD, ADHD, playing the drums. Yeah, oh, baby. Yeah. Matt, we're on a recording right now. Can you stop that? You know, and then I became a drummer. So then my dad brought me back a set of drums from Japan. Then I played drums and with 35-year-old people when I was 12, 13, 14, 15, 16. So I had a rock and roll history that was powerful and amazing, and I was ready to pretty much be on my own when I was 15 and 16, as far as I didn't know how to live, but I knew how to be talented and thrive. Here's where the art kind of came in. I went to one high school in Delaware. I played an orchestra. I got to play the 3D drums, George of the Jungle, and I got to be, you know, playing Shaft on the drum field in a white Americana, Future Farmers of America, during the race riots. So I've always been a rebel without abandon or rebel without applause, and always got to do things where our communities were brought together in Delaware, because I went against someone for class president. And I won because I had the black vote, but I was called a Polish inward dog, you know, and all kinds of things, and threatened as a child. But I'd been beaten by my father. So what, someone my own size is going to threaten me? You know, it didn't really work for them the way they wanted it to. So, yeah, pretty much always been an equalizer of inclusivity, diversity, cultural competence, in the Air Force, my mom would play spin the bottle with people from all over the world, and black kids are kissing white girls, and, you know, the Southern people be getting all upset. You know, and so we were just a mixed smash of the 60s. My parents were doing sock hops. This is the creative spot. My father would go buy new stereos and blast it until it was blown. Then he'd go buy the next new Japanese stereo, you know, because we vetted Germany and Japan as our trophies, countries of democracy. Right. So we benefited from that. I hope that helps a little.
Yeah. And, you know, my question, too, and to kind of follow up on what Esther was asking, is during these years, both the, like, especially when you were on your own, was there any, besides music, anything towards the art? I mean, did you sketch? Did you do that? Or is that something that developed later? So, I mean, did you like, but I mean, was there a process that you said, okay, I'm going to start sketching, I'm going to start doing this? Maybe tell them.
Yeah. No paper, no pen, no colors. I was a very sketchy artist. That's indeed sketchy. For real. No, that's a joke I made for some people, but I like to use it often. With the art, no, but my mother was a poet. So my mother, when Martin Luther King died, John F. Kennedy died, she wrote a poem and sent it to the Washington Post. It got published. When Martin Luther King died, she wrote a poem. It got published. When Robert Kennedy died, she wrote a poem. And it got published. And I'm getting chills now because I amoebicized my mother's stuff, but I took it to the next level of radical, you know, all of that powerful history.
Imagery. Yeah. So it seems like the music was your artistic release and pleasure throughout most of these years and you're continuing. So did you always continue throughout your whole time in San Francisco playing music?
Oh my goodness. Yes. I was in punk groups.
You know, let's talk about your recovery process and how that maybe influenced your art later. I mean, first of all, tell us a little bit about how, at what point you decided that, okay, this has got to stop, and then how that developed into that, and then maybe even how that developed into your art.
Thank you. Well, it didn't stop. Honey, can you come get the screen for me so I can show them my books without it being...
Did I read that you have 3 books? Have you written 3 books? Yeah. Or?
Yeah, this is the...
But just talk about your books. So, Riding Shotgun Through a Hurricane.
Where are they available?
No, I just wanted to say, how did the art start?
Yeah.
It started from being homeless on the streets. Homeless on the streets means you're out in the cold. You're walking on the streets every night. That's 27 years of being not in a place where you're safe. Does that make sense?
Yes, of course.
No.
So it's not like just I took a walk over there. It's
no, 27 years
traumatic,
is, you know,
traumatic,
like...
traumatic thing where you're sleeping. Someone might pour gas on you and kick you. You're waking up. AIDS happened. I was a nurse's aide, and I witnessed 10,000 people dying of HIV while I was living in San Francisco. I was the one they put in because I was a registry nurse. And then I'm seeing people that I was having fun with that are now in the baths, per se, and then I'm seeing them dying of HIV.
Sure.
Make sense?
Right, sure.
Not having a permanent home.
So during these 27 years, were you writing?
I was working. I worked to stay alive. I was always a foreman of a group of indigents, prison release. Every rock and roller, every poor person you could have, I'd give them $12 an hour to kill Whitey. That means work hard, and I'll give you $12 an hour. But put your frustration into, well, you may have something against the man, but work hard and have a sense of self-worth and dignity. And pride. And I raised what people call bottom feeders or disenfranchised, lower, disenfranchised, invisible populations. I would work with them and give them sense of worth and dignity and value by giving them jobs, not by dehumanizing them, objectifying them, name calling them, and then being able to kill them or incarcerate them, that kind of thing. So that's part of my creative journey. I was around artists, musicians, and I want you guys to repurpose your questions because I can go off on many routes here.
Right.
Well, you have a book. I mean, you had a tangible book in your hand. When did you start? So I know the stories start from the moment you're born, but when did you actually start writing the book? And when did your style of art, when did you start to put that on paper?
Okay, well, when I met Kat, in 1998, November, I finally, this is a blathering, I called myself double psychotic, paranoid, schizophrenic, and they diagnosed me as bipolar, manic, depressive with psychotic features. But that was just to get me started, and then I had to work on 30 or 40 or 50 things to be a fully realized human, real thriving on all levels, and not my diagnosis.
Or, so did you meet Kat, your wife, in San Francisco or here in Indiana?
Well, I had done 2 years in a behavioral modification facility called Walden House, and it was the precursor of Synanon. It was attack therapy. All of the things you watch on TV, I was doing those things. They were just confrontation therapy. They were trying all of the new genres of mental health wellness. And I was around creative people musically. I would always be starting art shows because I built things. I would take anybody and build things with them, warehouses, redo it, and there'd be art shows. And art and music were always all around me. And then the sex and drugs and rock and roll, of course.
Well, what started getting you into creating your art? What was the actually, you got the books, you've come through recovery, you met your wife. What actually started you to produce the art that you do now produce?
Well, when I was homeless, I would be digging through the trash. I'd have bloody arms, and I'd find objects of broken things that people threw away. And the cops would come up, "Oh, it's Kowalski." They'd had right away from me, right? So, but I'd find all these broken objects of all of these people's things, and the inside objects where they wouldn't see what made it were weird designs, unique pats. And they became my models. And I gathered 300 models. I would get the paints out of the newspapers, get the printing inks. I would get the papers out of Kinko's. I would start doing my art. And then when it got kicked out, it'd all be thrown away, and I'd start again. So that's my radical relief art. And it's radical relief because it was good for my mental health. I was able to, with these designs, have a sense of self-worth and dignity with my art.
Where have you exhibited? I mean, we have your exhibit list here, but and I guess the other part of that in your journey question is what brought you to Northwest Indiana, and then where did you start exhibiting your art and your kind of you kind of got your recovery done?
I know. I would love to hear how you made the leap from doing this art to then bringing it to the attention of the galleries that showed it. I mean, that's wonderful. So, what was the impetus?
Thank you. I love that. Well, there's some paper underneath all my trash in the bottom of a closet when I met Kat. And I pulled it out and I said, "Oh, I did these." And then I'm crying. Ah! She said, "Oh, those are nice." I'm like, "Ah!" And then she said, "Can I have a couple of these?" I said, "Sure." And then we started healthy dating, 13 healthy dates. We needed 13 more, no sex, blah, blah, blah. So then I was like, "Holy crap, this is a human. What do you do?" So I went to her house and I looked on the wall. I said, "Wow, where did these come from?" And she said, "Look over there." And I was like, "Oh my God, what is that?" And it was my art. I didn't even recognize it. So that's how the art started.
So beautiful.
Yeah. And then I just was embraced in artist community where I was loved, embraced, and valued, which I am here also in. A3 is a great, great artistic community. The Photography Club is a great artistic community. The Miller Group, Valparaiso, the Art Barn, Lubesnik, Chesterton, Hannah, met Hannah. I'm just going to brief it up. I'm into multiple communities having a simultaneous experience, many minds with one voice, instead of fighting for disparity of, oh, we've got this and we're the ones. No, I want to just say we're all the ones around here. It's a tiny, small, little place. And I want to start partnering with Chicago and developing real equity with them, because we have it all going on down here.
Matt, how do we find your book?
My books are on Amazon, all three of them. They're called Riding Shotgun Through a Hurricane, Crawling Through the Wreckage into Recovery, A Treasure Chest of Wellness, Heal Your Trauma, Own Your Recovery, and Change Your Life. They're all on Amazon. They're well-priced, and I hope you enjoy them.
And do you have any exhibits coming up?
I do. I'm showing right now at Miller. I sold three of my paintings, and I sold five of the little ones that the gallery gets the money for. So they're doing well. I have a show with Patty Roberts, Wes Thorne, and Miller Beach, an abstract show on May 1st of next year. I have a show at Anything Goes at the Marquette Mall in Michigan City with A3 on April 11th. And I have a painting in the Chesterton Art Center's member exhibition, which is up until January 23rd.
Right. Well, we appreciate you coming on Art in the Air and sharing your arts and your actual life journey. And you don't, I don't think, have a website, but you can be found on Facebook. Just do a search, Matt Kowalski, and you can find him there. Matt, thank you so much for coming on Art in the Air and sharing your whole journey.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate and value the way you create community. And I love you guys and wish you well on your journey.
Yeah, same. Congratulations, Matt.
Art in the Air listeners, do you have a suggestion for a possible guest on our show? Whether it's an artist, musician, author, gallery, theater, concert, or some other artistic endeavor that you are aware of, or a topic of interest to our listeners, email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com. We'd like to thank you for listening to Art on the Air. Our show relies on the support of not only our show underwriters, but also our listeners who make donations to this station. Your support of this station will ensure Art on the Air may continue bringing you the best of the arts and culture programming for Northwest Indiana and beyond. If Art on the Air is important to you, please consider supporting this station with a one-time contribution or even making an ongoing sustaining contribution. For information on how to make a contribution, go to this station's website or our show website, breck.com/AOTA. And thank you.
I am writer, television, and radio personality Mark Edward Willows, and you're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, and on WVLP, 103.1 FM.
We would like to welcome Michelle Steiner to Art on the Air. Michelle lives with an invisible disability. From the start, many people told her she could not go to college, get her bachelor's degree, get published, or have the job she wanted. She has done all of that and more. She received her degree in community programming, has had numerous articles published, and is also a photographer. She works as a paraeducator in a school with students with disabilities. Thank you for joining us on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome, Michelle. It's very nice meeting you.
Oh, hello. Yes, it's great to be here today.
Well, Michelle, our audience always wants to know the origin of our guests, like I say, their origin story. So tell us how you got from where you were to where you are now.
Well, I was born in Butler, Pennsylvania, as you can see in the backdrop behind there. And a lot of that had a significant impact on my story in my life. From the time I was very young, I was diagnosed with having a learning disability. Whenever I was in kindergarten, my teacher really noticed that I was struggling in the classroom. I had a lot of difficulty with writing, with writing my name, counting, tying my shoes, anything math related. And she recommended to my parents that I get tested for having a learning disability. And sure enough, I have one. And that changed a lot of my life throughout those years and the life of my parents. I had to repeat the grade, and I had to begin to receive specialty instruction and accommodations. And it was a struggle for me, both socially and academically, all throughout my years in school.
So what year was that, Michelle? Because it's highly sensitive. I mean, yes. For a teacher to pick that out at such a young age.
I was indeed fortunate. It had to be about 1985, 1986. Wow. So, yeah. And legislation was just passed a few years prior for students with disabilities. So it was I was very fortunate to have that identified.
Right. And there also is a social part of that that can be, I remember way back when I had a student back in grade school that was held back. And I remember the teacher handled it very delicately. But for the person, you know, having to do that, she sat down and explained to all of us while he wasn't in the room. And, you know, I remember that. But that sometimes for you can be a social challenge also.
It really was a big social challenge for me, especially the school that I went to was very small, and it was a close-knit community if you were one of them and you fit in. And it was really evident from the start, I didn't fit in with one of them. When I went into learning support, I had a lot of peers who struggled more with reading and behavior issues. Looking back, some of them had trauma backgrounds, and some of them didn't have learning disabilities. They were just kind of put in the classroom because nobody else knew what to do. And I got bullied there. And then in regular ed, whenever I started to be able to be in regular ed classes for things such as reading, science, and social studies, I couldn't hide the fact that I struggled in the classroom, even with having the supports. And that I went to learning support to have the accommodation of a test read aloud to me and to have extra time on it, and also to have those classes and learning support. So I quickly got labeled the outcast. And when I was younger, it was, well, you're not invited to my birthday party, or you're not my friend. And then as I get through high school, it got a lot harder for me socially. Academically, it got easier. Socially, it got a lot harder because all the peer groups became really defined, and I just didn't feel like I fit in with anybody. And I can just remember the threats really did it. It got to the point of threats for that, and just wasn't connecting with my peers. And I realized that I was going to have to look elsewhere if I was going to find people that my tribe, essentially. Right. So I found a group right outside of our school district that was an arts group. And I started to hang out with these people that I didn't go to school with, and they had the same interests that I did. And I found acceptance. And then after I transitioned out of that group, I found a writing group for adults. And they got to see me grow as a writer and a person. And they really encouraged me, you should write about having a learning disability. And at that time, I was not ready for that. I wrote some really bad poetry and some other things I wouldn't want to read today. And the amazing thing with that is 30 some years later, we still meet once a month to talk about our writing, and we're in each other's lives.
Wow.
So they identified this learning disability that you have very early, and you, and yes, there's a tremendous amount of peer interaction that happens and doesn't happen during that. So you kind of had this super writing power as you got older, but what was your sort of superpower in those early years? Because we all have areas that we love and excel in, you know, beyond the things that we don't. So could you identify one early? And did you have like one friend? Was there at least one person you could rely on in those early years?
I did have some friends, though. There were some friends in my early years that I did have at least one or two people that I could, that I definitely were nice with. I could see throughout school.
Good.
That was one of the things, too. One of the things they found out I was really good at was reading, writing, and also with speaking. That they found I could do that really well. When I was young, my dad would read a story to me every night when I was little. And I'll never forget whenever I wrote a story about a dinosaur in second or third grade, and my dad found it, and he said, this is really good. And that changed my life, because up until that point, I didn't think I was good at anything. I thought, I don't have any talents. And when he said that, that just boosted my self-esteem. And all of a sudden, reading and writing really became my world. And they also knew that I could speak pretty well, too. Even though I had speech class, because my ears were clogged, I can remember when at our family's church, when we would have time to speak where our class would go up. They always gave me some Bible verses to read because they knew that I could read well of my students. And that's something the teachers also noticed as I went throughout high school. They wanted to get me up in front of the classroom to be speaking because I was really good at that.
And so you were kind of finding your superpower back then and speaking. And of course, this whole reading and it all kind of links up. Well, so through school, kind of like how was it set that they kind of predestined you not to be able to go to college as you were developing these skills? I mean, it seems like you took it on as a challenge. Like, okay, they say I can't do that, but I can. But tell us about that journey.
Well, whenever I was in high school, I was in all regular ed classes except for math and a resource room, and my grades were doing well with having regular academics. I was making honor roll. I was doing great in everything except math, and we knew that, and we were taking care of that in the learning support classroom and in my resource room. But when we were talking about, well, what am I going to do after high school, I knew I wanted to go to college, but I understood math was going to be very difficult for me. And my learning support teacher realized that too. And she said, I don't think you can handle going to college because of your difficulty with math. Why don't you go to a trade school? Wow. And nothing at the trade school interested me. But I decided, I got connected with Office for Vocational Rehabilitation. And they said, that sounds feasible for you to go to community college, study early childhood education. They were all on board with that, especially since I didn't take the ACTs or the SATs. They said, well, if you ever wanted to go to university, a lot of colleges will just look at how well you did at a community college before that. And I had to get tested for having a learning disability all over again before I could receive any of the funding or the services. And the psychiatrist who evaluated me, I scored very low on all my tests. And he wrote right on my paper, most likely won't go beyond community college. No. I get to community college, and I find even more stigma with my staff, staff that work there, and the students. Things such as disability accommodations were considered cheating. When I asked for a calculator, I had a professor that said, no, we use our brains in this class, not calculators. And when I asked for just having some of those accommodations, people thought they were giving me an unfair advantage. And I had an advisor who told me, well, you're pretty much going to not be able to, you're going to have limited job choices once you're done with school because of your math. And I was really discouraged. And I didn't use a lot of those services, and I really struggled. And finally, I had a professor that really encouraged me. She said, why don't we at least get you extra time on tests? And I was able to do that. And I passed. I did not do well in her class, but I was able to pass her class, and I was able to move on and get my associate's in early childhood education, which I loved. I moved out on my own. I worked some temp jobs in some centers, especially since I can't drive. So living in a central location where I could walk to places or take the bus was really nice to have that independence and help me to grow as a person. But I always wanted more for myself. And be careful what you wish for, because for financial reasons, I had to move back in with my parents during that time. I had a job that was downsizing. And I thought, I'm going to give university a try. And I really researched a lot of programs. I found one that had the least amount of math and science possible with the program I wanted. It had disability accommodations, too. And when I got there, I used the accommodations. I had a note taker. I had extra time on tests. I had tutoring. And I was also really comfortable with advocating for myself. I would go up to a new professor and say, hi, my name's Michelle. I have a learning disability, and these are the supports I'm going to need. And most people were so kind and so understanding. And a few didn't get the memo, but that was okay, too. And I did so much better. My grades improved dramatically. I made Dean's List for a semester, and I was able to graduate with a bachelor's degree despite being told I couldn't do it.
Isn't that so amazing that you had so much more sensitivity in elementary school than you did in community college? Like, I don't think very many people in that early thing said that you weren't going to... I mean, like, how could they not look at your writing and speaking ability and know that you would just excel, you know, that math wasn't needed in that equation, literally?
It just wasn't.
Right. You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, on WVLP, 103.1 FM.
Well, and sometimes in college, I know I started out studying engineering. Of course, the math is super complicated, and I wasn't terrible at math. Right. But when I changed to a humanities thing, they nicknamed it dum-dum science and dum-dum math, and it really was. And it's like, okay, this is stuff I learned. And the science class, I had me deal with the professor because I actually knew him because he was one of my advisors. I didn't have to show up to class. I just came in and took the test because this was like, oh my gosh, this is so elementary.
Right.
That was my accommodation in college is like, okay, I don't like because I changed from an engineering major to, you know, humanities, communications and things. So you get through college, you get your bachelor's degree.
Yeah.
So now tell us the next step in your journey.
Well, one of the things, I also met my husband during that time. So we got married. So that was one of the things that happened during that. And I also, the next step obviously was getting a job. And I found a lot of jobs that said that they were disability friendly or anything but that. And things didn't really work out. And it took me a while, but I eventually found my job with the school as a paraeducator. And I've been with my district for about 13 years, and I love working with students in the classroom. And I feel that having the disability helps me to be able to help a lot of my students that have them. I understand what a lot of them are feeling. I'm working with seventh graders this year, and I hear a lot of students, not all of them, but a lot, that will say, I hate my disability. I don't feel very smart. And I get that chance to go in the room and say, well, you are smart. And I'll show them how to advocate for themselves, because all those students that come in, they're going to one day leave me, but they're going to, for a lot of them, their disabilities are going to be there. So I think it's just so important that they learn now how to be able to speak up for themselves. And I think that if I didn't have this, I would definitely have sympathy for somebody that does struggle with learning, but I would never really understand what it's like to sit in that seat and how scared you can be.
Valuable that you have them take it from all this like internal angst and to express what they need. It's just, I mean, it's going to serve them always.
Right. A lot of times I'll have a student that'll come in and they'll be like, I don't understand this. And I'll say, okay, well, you got to ask the teacher. Well, and they all know, do not ask me for help with math. We go over that a lot too. I can't. And
I'll redirect you to where you should go for that.
Yeah, exactly. And sometimes I'll have that student that's so afraid to ask for help, and I'll go with them and I'll have them speak up for themselves usually. And they're not afraid anymore. They're raising their hand. They're going up to a teacher. They're asking for help. And it's just amazing to be able to do that.
Right. To be able to say, I don't understand. Right. Because we all learn differently. Forget about whether you have a learning disability or not. We all have our own unique way of learning.
I think the thing with math teachers, too, is most people that are math teachers got it. You know what I mean? And they don't understand the person that doesn't quite get it. You know, I was okay in math, but, you know, there was you're just like, I wasn't brilliant in math. And, you know, and you see them and they, well, don't you understand this? Well, no, I need you to explain it to me. One of the things I wanted to ask you about is we are now seeing challenges to DEI kind of be labeled as a negative thing. I'm sure you have feelings about that. I mean, here we thought we really made progress in that area, and all of a sudden that's under assault. So tell us what you feel about that.
I think with having DEI, that is something that has really served me with getting the, first of all, being identified, because if I, nobody would have understood that. I don't know how, I would have got through school, but it would have been a lot more challenging for me. I wouldn't have got the supports that I need. And I think that that has really helped me with going throughout my public school years. And then also with college, if I didn't have the funding to be able to go to college, then I don't know how I would be able to do that and to get the support services with that. And so I definitely think that that is something that is not a bad thing for students who do have that, because that is what gives that service and gives that ability to, for people to be able to do that.
Now, you have podcasts out there. So you're actually, what we're doing today in those radio show class podcasts, you have that mm-hmm. plus a book. Tell us about some of that part of your journey. You're the paraeducator, but you're also out there doing speaking engagements. Tell us about that whole universe of things that you're doing.
I also have been part of my journey. I do share my story on podcast and other platforms. I have a blog called Michelle's Mission, where I write about my life with a learning disability, and I get to feature my photography as well. I became a published author a few years ago, and I was diagnosed with limited hand dexterity. And I can remember I was so frustrated after my husband and I moved into our home, I could not unlock our front door. And there was a call on the mighty for what's a seemingly easy task for others, but is really hard with your disability. And I thought, oh, I'm ready to write about this. And I had such a great following and such a great response that it just encouraged me to write more articles for them and to write for other places and to start my own blog. And then the photography came up as well, too. That was another big thing that happened. I'm not able to drive, so I take pictures on my walks. And rather than being sad when I don't have a ride to get somewhere, I get that chance to stop and smell the roses and notice details that other people will miss. And I think rather than being sad about that, I just get to think there's so much I would miss, and there's just so much beauty on these walks and just so much beauty with having a disability.
So, Michelle, how does your learning disability affect your day-to-day right now, today?
Right. One of the things that is math is hard, budgeting, right. Knowing how much money that, you know, is going in, how much is going out. I cannot read the face of an analog clock. I'm not able to drive. I have difficulty with my fine motor skills with opening up jars, opening up doors. Sometimes just processing different directions can be really hard for me as well. And I also confuse my right from my left.
And yet, you know, speaking to you as we are now, you would never know any of this. I mean, it seems like a totally awesome person here that's doing all these great things. And, you know, the fact that you shared that is interesting, but they're invisible to us. And I know that's what you put. It's an invisible disability.
Mm-hmm. It is.
So future projects you have, tell us about, you know, you got the blog, you've got, you're sharing, you're doing speaking engagements, you're writing. What things do you have that you haven't done yet, but you want to do?
I would definitely like to write a book someday about having a disability. And I also have a children's story that I would love to get published about dyscalculia as well.
You know, we have about a few minutes left here, but tell us about some of the topics you cover, like in your podcast. You touched a little bit on that, but, you know, tell us about what you share in your podcast and your writings.
I usually, in my writing, I will do a lot of nature themes. So I might write about the process of accepting my disability as like a flower that's unblooming, or I love butterflies. So I might talk about the transition process that a butterfly goes through and the transitions that I have too. So I try to make that easy for somebody with a disability to be able to understand, or a family member. And there's a lot of misconceptions about that. So I try to really clear that up in the writing. And also whenever I speak, I might be speaking to college students that just to encourage them, or I might have parents that might be out there and they might have a child that has a disability and maybe some ways to help them. I also might just do maybe a general thing where I'll just be able to tell my story and just be able to encourage, empower, and educate people with and without disabilities.
Got a question about your photography. Do you use your camera phone or do you actually use a DSLR and do you post-process?
I have both. I do have a camera and I also have, but I mainly, when I'm on my walks, I will just use the on my phone. The camera on my phone for that. And it's a little easier to be able to take around and get the pictures and to be able to go through and be able to clean them up as well.
Yeah, on your website, I see lots of flowers and a few butterflies and actually balloon and everything. So I see that's your topics. Yeah, we have a lot of
hot air balloon was really beautiful.
Yes, it is.
Oh, thank you.
Well, we're in our final minute here, Michelle. We want to give you a chance how people can find you online and if they want to reach out to you, how to contact you, whatever you want to do like that. So Facebook and or web.
You can find me at my blog, michellesmission.com, and I am on Facebook and Instagram as well.
Okay. Well, we appreciate you coming on the air and sharing your unique journey, not so much about art, but it's about the great challenge that you have overcome. And I think our audience will appreciate the struggle that you had that you actually made such a success of. Michelle, thank you so much for coming on Art on the Air Spot and sharing your journey.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Yes. Thank you so much, Michelle.
We'd like to thank our guests this week on Art on the Air, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. Art on the Air is heard Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Art on the Air is also heard Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at wvlp.org. If you have a smart speaker like Amazon Alexa, Google Assistant, or Apple Siri, just tell it to play Art on the Air to hear the latest episode. Our spotlight interviews are heard every Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Media. Thanks to Dee Dotson, Vice President of Radio Operations for Lakeshore Public Media, and to Greg Kovach, WVLP's Station Manager. Our theme music is by Billy Foster with a vocal by Renee Foster. We'd like to thank our current underwriters for Lakeshore Public Media, Ember Forge Consulting, thoughtful marketing and digital learning built to express your purpose and grow your reach. Learn more at emberforgeconsulting.com/grow. And for WVLP, Walt Breidinger of Paragon Investments. So we may continue to bring you Art in the Air, we rely on you, our listeners and underwriters, for ongoing financial support. If you're looking to support Art on the Air, we have information on our website at breck.com/AOTA, where you can find out how to become a supporter or underwriter of our program in whatever amount you are able. And like I say every week, don't give till it hurts. Give till it feels good. You'll feel so good about supporting Art on the Air. If you're interested in being a guest or sending us information about your arts, arts-related event or exhibit, please email us at AOTA@breck.com. That's AOTA@breck.com. BRECH.com, or contact us through our Facebook page. Your hosts were Larry Breckner and Esther Golden, and we invite you back next week for another episode of Art on the Air.
Aloha, everyone. Have a splendid week.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know. Esther and Larry are on the air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Are on the air our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world.